Hey, Crystal, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. I'll try to drag James in and see if he will respond. It's hard to tell. You never know.
He's there, so he should.
Something may have come up. Here we go. I'll drag him in.
Okay.
Well, that should work. I think he's... There we go.
Yes, hello.
Hello, James. How are you?
Pretty good. Marriage should be next.
I don't know if she's going to join us. You guys might have to persuade her a little bit. She's got... I don't know if she has something going on or... You guys are better at that than I am.
I'm not showing her online.
She may have already jumped off. Okay, let me see. I'll see what she says.
I thought she was going to be on.
She said she was, but I don't think she... She's got something going on with her brother, so... I just sent her a little message, and she can text me back if and when she wants to get involved in all this. So, last time, earlier this afternoon, we were talking about the moon landings, the B-58, Chernobyl, Bird's Expedition, in the Ukraine. So, maybe we should let Crystal choose which one of these she wants to address, or something else, if something else is more exciting right now.
Would it be bad if I said, can you say the list again?
Sure. We talked about the moon landings, the B-58 Hustler, which is a really cool plane, Chernobyl, Admiral Byrd's expedition, the Ukraine, and we talked about 9/11 a little bit, too. So.
Well, those are all really good topics.
Do you have a particular... What about the moon landings? I love the moon landing. Love to talk about the moon landing.
The moon landing that never was?
Yeah, you know, there's definitely some fakery going on there, but I don't know. I'll let you guys decide where you want to draw the line and all that. I was on the last show, I brought up the fact that the lunar module crashed the only time they tested it on the Earth here. And then they just built a new one and threw it in the rocket and went back up to the moon. And everything magically worked okay. So that's a strange thing that happened. Another strange thing is if you look at their suits, somehow these suits were able to withstand a change in temperature of maybe 200 plus degrees in the sun to 200 minus degrees.
That's a 1,000 degree variance.
A 1,000 degree variance?
Yeah, when they were in the sun, it was 256 degrees Fahrenheit, and when they were in the darkness, it was 256 degrees minus Fahrenheit.
That's quite a variation.
Yeah, it is.
So how-
and of course, it's all phony. I mean, there's no way. There's nothing more ludicrous in the world than the people that try to debunk those of us who can see it and smell this hoax a mile away. There are so many things that contradict the reality of this, and I've been reading one of them by David McGowan, who has put together the best analysis of it I've read. And I'm on part six, and it he's got it down. Anybody, after they read this, anybody that wants to go with those that want to debunk the people that are showing proof that this was a hoax, anybody that wants to go with the debunkers, it just doesn't know how to read or doesn't read well. Assuming they're honest, because it's just like saying, well, you know, if we try hard enough, we can climb Mount Everest with emphysema.
Well, Well, let's talk about some of the things that are strange about the moon landings. One of the things I've heard is that when they initially broadcasted this, that there was a Coke bottle that showed up in one of the scenes there on the moon.
Well, yeah, the earliest broadcast hit Australia.
Yeah, exactly.
And there were people that saw the descent from the lander. As his foot is being placed down, you see a Coke bottle. And of course, analysts that have pointed the hoax out also point out that the people responsible for making this phony landing have intentionally, some of them have intentionally left clues. And a rock, supposed to be a moon rock with a plain C on it, which is a prop rock.
Yeah,
and just one thing after another. But Stephen, Stanley Kubrick is supposed to have participated in that. It haunted him for the rest of his life, and he people point out clues in some of his subsequent movies. There is The Shining, for one, but there are a number of attacks on the validity of the moon landing that you can make, and in every case, they're just multiple anomaly that cannot stand up to scrutiny and do anything but challenge the validity of the moon landing. And one of the things that people, even Mr. McGowan, who I say has put together the very finest analysis of it, the moon landing was used by the Nixon administration to divert the American public from the escalation that he was creating in the war in Vietnam. And in the carrying that war into Cambodia. So it served the purpose very well, and that's one of the things that Mr. McGowan points out very well. But the one thing that's left out of all the analysis, and once you understand how this was used as a part of social engineering, you have to understand what the technology was at the time as opposed to what it is today. And that, without being able to actually conduct any exercise close to an experiment to replicate the conditions on the moon as opposed to those on Earth, that there is no way that the administration and NASA under its wing would have taken a chance of a failure. And this is replete with the probability of failure. I mean, from beginning, from start to finish. And it just boggles the mind that people can't realize that today. And one of the things that's at the very first part of Mr. McGowan's presentation, which I'm on the sixth part of, which I'd like to read. This is an extract. It's from the very first. And this attaches to the mindset most people have that don't want to address this objectively. Quote, but that is not the main reason that people cling so tenaciously, often even angrily, to what is essentially the adult version of Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy. What primarily motivates them is fear. But it is not the lie itself that scares people. It is what the lie says about the world around us and how it really functions. For if NASA was able to pull off such an outrageous hoax before the entire world and keep that lie in place for four decades, what does that say about the control of the information we receive? What does that say about the media and the scientific community and the educational community and all the other institutions we depend on to tell us the truth? What does that say about the very nature of the world we live in? couldn't say as well myself. Could not do it. I mean, he is. This is a great writer, a great mind, and he puts it all together. And I don't care what side of the fence that you wish to be on. Mm-hmm. You owe it to yourself and to your chance of survival in the years or in the months ahead to read this and realize that official versions of everything of import in the world today is probably just, pardon the expression, a sack of shit.
James, when we get you back on Revolution Radio, you'll have to tone it down a bit, I think. But no, you make a good point there. Even the aluminum foil.
Oh, it's supposed to be gold foil.
Yeah. The aluminum foil on the lunar module is so thin. I mean, you could literally, they'll even admit it, they could have accidentally poked their finger through it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was for show. It would have cost them a great deal to actually have anything. And, of course, what I read to you is what they relied upon. They relied upon people protecting their comfort zones over common sense.
Wow.
They did. And that's why this charade, which any person who actually knows much about science, not necessarily astronomer, but just science, who is looking at this, they're going to be perplexed. I know that when I saw this, I was sitting in one of these Rush courses, Russian, mm-hmm. at school, mm-hmm. and the instructor was a lady, Госпожа Райслинг, and she was really something. She was Russian, and she brought a television set in so we could watch the moon landing. And I'm sitting there, and of course it's black and white, and we don't have a really good connection, so you couldn't tell any of this. I mean, you couldn't. There wasn't enough. The reception wasn't good enough to really show the shadows, how they were cast, or anything else. But I kept looking at it and thinking, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. It just does, and of course, years later, when I went to Utah and had experiences there, and the first thing that occurred to me is how people were denied the tools necessary to see this objectively. So I don't look at it solely as a matter of incredulity. I look at it too. That we just didn't have the means at the time that this went on. And then once this was sold to us, we had a predilection to make us feel good about our country, make it feel good about technology, that there was something besides just warmongering behind technology. And that was the important thing. So we all kind of clung to that until later on when people that were closer to the phenomena begin to point out these incongruities.
Well, I can remember being, I don't know, I must have probably 8 years old or 10 years old when the first moon landing occurred, and I was shocked because the flag was waving on the moon. And I pointed that out to my parents, and they got real angry at me.
Oh, I know. Well, it was just, you were challenging what they had fallen in, the trap they had fallen into, to want to believe it so much that they would argue for it against common sense. And this is the way. Now, at the time, you didn't have the tools because nobody had the kind of television resolution that was watching this to really see that there was absolutely no dust on those pods, that there was no crater underneath the rocket tail, or the rocket cone, none. And that was, that to me, later on, whenever I started listening to people that were were far more attentive to this than me. Later on, when they started pointing this out, that convinced me right there. And then as I became more involved in what I had my head stuck into, somebody, you know, my life was like, you're growing up, you're trying to conform, and you're trying to fit in, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden a hand reaches out, grabs you by the nape of the neck, and puts your head in the commode and flushes it, then pulls it out and say, how did you like that? Now wake up and think.
That's probably how the people are going to feel when they start to wake up to this thing, because I think eventually this is going to come out. Now, maybe a whole generation has to die off before this comes, really, before the public really realizes it. I don't know.
We have another thing that we need to come to terms with, and Crystal is working on that now, and that is the truth about World War II and the Third Reich. How that was manipulated, how it was exploited, and then how many lies were told afterwards to vilify the German people. Crystal and I recently together saw a movie that's over 5.5 hours long that presents an alternative view to that whole sorry episode in history. And it challenges what we've been taught. It challenges the conceptions of what was going on at the time, and who was responsible, absolutely responsible for the situation in Germany to develop that would nest a Hitler and look upon Hitler as a savior. And, of course, in many ways he was. And this is the last thing, of course, that a interested party that has too much control and too much influence in this country want any of us to understand. And I'll turn this over to Crystal now. She'll tell you what she's up to.
Well, actually, before we get to that, I did want to discuss some additional things about the moon, because there are things that NASA has known about the moon for a very long time that they have not shared publicly. And I think that if they had shared it publicly, that the public would have questioned what they saw much, much earlier. There's an article on my blog called Odd Things NASA Knows About the Moon. It's a snippet from my first book, which isn't available anymore. And these came from a book written by David Hatcher Childress called The Anti-Gravity Handbook. And he was very kind in allowing me to include this section in my first book. And this section is called 11 Things That NASA Discovered About the Moon That You Never Knew. And James can actually probably add some more details to some of these, but they're very, very interesting. And the first one is the puzzle of the moon's origin. Scientists have offered three major theories to account for the moon in orbit around our planet. All of the theories are in doubt and none satisfactory. NASA scientist Dr. Robin Brett sums it up best. It seems easier to explain the non-existence of the moon than its existence. The puzzle of the moon's age. Incredibly, over 99% of the moon rocks brought back turned out upon analysis to be older than 90% of the oldest rocks that can be found on Earth. Other rocks turned out to be even older, 4.3, 4.5, and 4.6 a billion years old. And the area of the moon rocks, the area that the moon rocks came from, was thought by scientists to be one of the youngest areas of the moon. The puzzle of how moon soil could be older than lunar rocks. The mystery of the age of the moon is even more perplexing when rocks taken from the Sea of Tranquility were compared to the soil in which they rested. Upon analysis, the soil proved to be at least 1 billion years older. This would appear impossible, since the soil was presumably the powdered remains of the rocks lying alongside it. Chemical analysis of the soil revealed that the lunar soil did not come from the rocks, but from somewhere else. The puzzle of why the moon rings like a hollow sphere when a large object hits it. This is a little questionable, but it says, during the Apollo mission, ascent stages of lunar modules, as well as the spent third stages of rockets, crashed on the hard surface of the moon. Each time, these caused the moon, according to NASA, to ring like a bell or gong. one of the Apollo 12 flights, there were reverberations lasting nearly an hour to as much as 4 hours. The puzzle of the mystifying Maria on the moon. The dark areas of the moon are known as Maria and are, strangely, located almost entirely on one side of the moon. Astronauts found it extremely difficult to drill into the surface of these dark plane-like areas. Soil samples were loaded with rare metals and elements like titanium, zirconium, yttrium, and beryllium. This dumbfounded scientists because these elements require tremendous heat, approximately 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit, and melt and fuse with surrounding rock as it had. The puzzle of the moon's strange magnetism. Early lunar tests and studies indicated that the moon had little or no magnetic field. The lunar rocks proved upon analysis to be strongly magnetized. This shocked scientists who had always assumed that the rocks had some very strange magnetic properties which were not expected. Explain where this magnetic field came from. And then there was another interesting source that David Hatcher Childress referred to. It was a book called Moongate, Suppressed Findings of the U.S. Space Program, the NASA Military Cover-Up, by William L. Bryan, and he was a nuclear engineer from Oregon State University. Of significance in Bryan's book is that the equation of the moon's gravity being 1/6 that of Earth's is nonsense, and that the true equation has not only been hidden from the general public, but the true equation means that the true fuel requirements based on the moon having a higher percentage of gravity reveals the startling conclusion that if men really landed on the moon in high lunar gravity conditions, it was not done with rockets. Bryan points out many obvious things that indicate a higher lunar gravity, including the fact that images of astronauts on the moon show them able to jump no higher than 18 inches. But of course, that would be referring back to the staged film again. But these were things that I already knew about the moon, anomalies that I knew about the moon, before I met James. And so, having looked at this, to me, it was clear that we had been there, because we knew too much about it, things that you could only know if you had been there and taken soil samples. But having looked at the way in which astronauts were said to have been there, and combining that with this particular information, I've never believed that we got there in rockets, because there are indications that it's not even possible. So this was one of the strange holes or anomalies in our reality that James is the first person I've ever come across who can fill. And he's explained many, many times, we did go to the moon, but the only way that we can get to the moon is with an EV craft.
The point you brought up about the moon's gravity is very interesting, because you would think that if the moon's gravity was quite a bit less than the gravity of the Earth, that the astronauts would have been running around like bunnies. They'd have been going in fast motion, not slow motion. We see them kind of move real slowly, like they're underwater. But in fact, it would have been just the opposite, correct?
Well, McCowan explains what you see as the way in which the camera is slowed down.
Yeah.
And it makes all the sense in the world. Now, the suggestion is, and the truth is, that the gravity on the moon is artificial, and that it is created from machines that are inside the moon, because the moon is a sculpted craft. And the rare elements and minerals that are common on the moon have already been mined elsewhere and are part of the makeup of that sculpted craft, because your ancestors used it to come into the system. This first place around Mars brought Mars to life. And then when your ancestors messed up on Mars, similar to what they had done in their original system, it was brought to Earth, placed around Earth. But it because of its inconstant mass and the disproportionate size to any ideal moon around Earth, It has to be kept in orbit artificially, and the use of those machines and engines on Earth do it. And this will explain the anomalies attached to variances that are reflected in pattern on Mars or on the Moon and on Earth co-jointly. And these are variations in the magnetic field and in gravitational field. And so these are two different things. What's the difference between a magnetic field and gravitational field? Magnetic field is going to affect beyond the immediate area. It's going to affect objects around it. Gravitational field relates to basically math, the mathematic equation of mass times density. But in reality, none of these things remain constant. So this action accounts for why. And this is a long-time anomaly that's never been addressed publicly by scientists, why the Moon and Earth have an inconstant gravity wave.
Let's step back in time a little bit. I'd like to go back to the time that the Great Pyramid was constructed in Egypt. And I'd like to talk a little bit about how Egypt fits into this chronology that you're describing of humans coming to Mars and then causing some catastrophe on Mars and then eventually coming to the Earth. Can you tell us, it seems like all of the artifacts in Egypt, whether it's the Great Pyramid or some of these incredible sculptures that exist, which I'd like to talk about in a little bit.
Which are mirrored, in a way, by what you find on the plain of Sidonia on Mars.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. It seems to me the people that built these structures in Egypt were at a higher level of advancement than we are currently. Correct me if I'm wrong.
They had taken more of the right path towards technology and unified consciousness and wanted to leave. What's on the plain of Sidonia was built as a monument of what they had been there, so that it would kind of touch off an awakening, a memento of the past. And when Earthbounds had reached a point where they had the technology to venture beyond their planet, would be kind of like a waybill for finding out about their past and maybe reconstructing a technology and an approach to science and civilization that could aspire beyond just Earth and therefore become something besides Earthbounds. Everybody out there calls you guys Earthbounds, and there's a reason for that. And Earthbound humans, and even your own kind that went somewhere else during the Great Exodus, called you Earthbounds.
So Sidonia on Mars is kind of a mirror image of what we see in Egypt, or should I say vice versa? When the civilization...
What inspired the patterns of the city building, the monument building in Egypt, was taken from that legacy. There are pyramids in Egypt that are far older than Egyptian culture you see today.
Oh, sure, of course. Yeah. I think they're like, my personal opinion is right around 73,000 years old.
That's a good guess. That's pretty close, yeah. Pretty close. And they were built towards the end of an extinction. You've had six extinctions here. You've had one that was more advanced technologically and even socially than yours today. But yours has done more damage to the earth than all the others put together, because you have a sickness, you have a disease that has exercised influence and control broadly and widely through international banking. And that's not in common with the other extinctions. The other extinctions occurred over just misapplication of technology, because you people are, when you had your own system, you were so ruthlessly independent that you wouldn't join an extended community and take advice from people that could have saved you devastation. You're like that here. There are ETs that have sat down with presidents and world leaders here to discuss averting what is going on now. And, if you don't promise your world leaders technology and make things even worse, then they're not interested in your wisdom.
And there is something else I would like to point out about what you were just discussing, Mark, about the pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
In my early research, because I'm a pattern person, I'm always looking for patterns, and one of the patterns that stood out to me right away is that the farther back you go, the more technologically advanced we were. And this, of course, flies in the face of it completely defies what has passed for logic in terms of humans evolving from apes, doesn't it? And it also lends a great deal of validity to James's claims about us having come from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And there are also past life regression sessions that verify what he said about our past. And it also explains where the moon came from, which is something that NASA has been grappling with unbeknownst to the public. So I think that this is very important. Sentience is a very, very special thing. I don't know if James would like to maybe explain that a little bit more, but I think that there's a mindset that runs the planet, and it's constantly trying to encourage us to devolve, if that's even the right word, considering that we were more evolved in the past. But it's very debasing, and reducing us to intelligent animals or monkeys, I think, is very much part of that. But we were a very great people once, and I think that it's really time that we reclaim our true history. That's very important. But sentience and this is something that I never really even thought about until James began to discuss it, but it makes a great deal of sense in that sentience isn't evolutionary. I don't know if you maybe want to comment on that a little bit more, James, because I think it's really beautiful.
Well, sentience comes from one place. It when I was a kid, I was always trading my books, and I traded them for some geology books and archaeology books, and took them home and stuck my nose in them and tried to make sense of them, and I noticed that there was this, maybe they were a little older than the what was current at the time. I don't think so. But there was still this belief in parallel evolution, that blacks evolved and then Mongolians evolved and that Caucasians evolved. We all are brothers and sisters. We develop over time in different environments through natural selection. And natural selection is one of these things that people get up on their high horse and say, oh, you're talking Darwin and all this crap. I'm not. I'm talking about something we see every day. What happens in all that natural selection is, and I'd like to just take a minute and explain it. Natural selection is that when your environment changes radically, then there are certain types of people with certain traits that are going to do better in this new radically changed environment than others that don't have these traits. they're going to reproduce more, they're going to be more successful, and eventually they will become the dominant type. That doesn't mean militarily or through hostilities or anything. It's just a fact of nature that these people have more ability to adjust. That's natural selection. That's all that it is. You see it in birds. You see it in ducks. You see it in all animals. That the sparrow in industrial England, eventually the sparrow became darker and darker to be less of a target for the hawks in the background of the ash and the gray that was on the buildings from the soot of the industrial production. So this is a fact. You know, I'm not talking about something that hasn't been studied. But this is natural selection. And so we don't have, what I'm talking about is that the differences in humanity here is not caused because that race of people evolved separately. They don't. I mean, this is ridiculous. This is a mathematical certainty that that's not true. So what you have is that take an Eskimo. An Eskimo is smaller in stature. He has the ability to contain body heat because he has less skin surface area to dissipate it. You take Africa. These people are longer in limb. They're taller. They have more surface area to dissipate the heat, which is a good thing for their environment, you see. I mean, on and on. I can give you, I mean, there's certain people that have really thick earwax and certain people that have very thin earwax because thin earwax is protects you from the cold and giving earaches, and thin keeps your ears from becoming compacted with this earwax. So when you start thinking about these things and seeing these differences, this parallel evolution BS just flies out the window because it is mathematically improbable, if not impossible. And so, if you know, it is a current belief among many, many civilizations that all sentience comes from the same place. Just a matter of how, and we change. And this promotes the idea of a universal kind of brotherhood. It's a good thing. And once we understand that, then we stop looking down on people because of ethnicity so much or because they're a different color, they have different traits or whatever. The mix, the genetic mix, is at its best with variation. The universe has a consciousness, and it rates variation, variety, or whatever, very, very highly, and is constantly wanting to experiment to find something new and see if it's better. And that isn't because they're going to remove the weak or remove where. No, we'll give them something to aspire to. You know, there's so many ways we can adapt. The individual can adapt. It doesn't take generations.
You said something very interesting there about a universal consciousness, and I agree with that. There is universal consciousness, and it's not anthropomorphic.
No.
It's not a human like God that's depicted as angry or jealous, and it doesn't get involved in human warfare.
No, as a matter of fact, one of the things that I find so quaint is that people want to make a god that is in there that has a human-like personality and is to be feared and to be this and that. I look at God as I see that there is something above me, something beyond me, something I will never understand. And there's a reason for that. It's the same reason that E.T. cannot enter an EMV or even go near it. That there is a distance to be maintained there with something grander, with something more powerful than you that has a benevolence is the most wonderful sorting out mechanism to remove hostility, to remove bigotry, to remove the idea of military conquest over others that there is. And it keeps the civilized part of the universe going, keeps it civilized, keeps it growing in good ways, in accommodating ways. You have people coming in, through this area constantly trying to figure out what the hell is wrong with this planet. That's what happened at Kolaris. And so, you know, the concern, it is natural for sentient beings to be concerned over other sentient beings, especially those that are in the plight we're in today.
Well, I want to step back to Egypt for a minute, because there's our physical evidence, in my opinion, that there was a higher, more advanced civilization in our past. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this particular, these two particular monuments. They're called the Colossi of Memnon. There are two massive statues. One is 60 feet high. They're both 60 feet high, and they weigh an estimated 720 tons. They stand in Thebes, Egypt. And just to put that in perspective, 720 tons is 1,440,000 pounds. And these statues were said to have been transported 420 miles over land. So, it's, to me, there's more evidence than just the Great Pyramids in Egypt that there was a very, very advanced civilization there. What do you guys think?
Well, the Colossus of Rhodes is even more remarkable. Of course, it was lost at the same time the Mediterranean was created.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell us about that more. Do you have any more information?
Well, the Great Flood, the one that supports the notion of Noah, was when the ocean broke through and fed the Mediterranean. That's in relatively recent times, you know, about 32,000 years ago.
32,000?
Yeah, it was recent times. You guys have been here on Earth for, roughly 270,000 years.
How many civilizations have risen and fallen in that 270,000 years? Six?
Six.
Six?
Yeah, one of them was ahead of yours, technologically and socially.
Mm-hmm. Also in Egypt is something called the unfinished obelisk.
Yeah.
Which I think is the largest known ancient obelisk. It would have been 137 feet high, but when they were quarrying it out of Aswan in Egypt, I think there was a crack that appeared, and then they abandoned the project.
Yeah. Well, there are two forms of art among the megalithic monument builders, and one of them is to edify a pharaoh or a dynasty. And the other is to edify a god or goddess. And sometimes these two things get mixed up and come together, and you have, again, the same tendency the Greek and Romans had to, and going back to the Babylonians and other cultures even older, is to try to apply a human personality to a god or goddess. And, of course, that's juvenile. That's absurd. And but it's kind of like trying to draw a caricature of a person, you know, combine the features of a cartoon character and apply them to a person. It's just absurd. And so, you know, it's not even funny whenever it's a god or goddess. But that's what they did, and the Greeks were much, much more closer to being primitive than the Romans. They named everyone after animals. They really, they when they performed, they had little theaters, and when they performed, the actors would always wear masks that made them appear twice their normal size. And, you know, here's that actor down there carrying around this chunk of wood that weighs 35 or 40 pounds. Don't you think that was... those guys and those ladies had to be really tough.
You know, there is one other really important point that I don't want people to overlook in the context of what we're talking about, because not just our individual thoughts and perceptions, but our thought patterns have been managed for so long that we rarely deviate from those patterns. And one of the patterns that is very heavily ingrained in our civilization, which I think has a tone of debasement to our history and our culture, is that when we go back and we look at an advanced civilization, what's the first thing people say? Oh, it must be aliens, right? Aliens must have done that. But in fact, we are going back and digging up the remnants of ourselves.
Exactly. We're not from here.
Well, when we were on Mars, we excavated Mars to look for former civilizations there. In one of Kevin Smith's shows, he found an excavation, and it was about our excavation of a society and peoples from earlier times. And, you know, people just don't stop and think. You know, we have so many anomalies in archaeology that people don't ever stop and think, this civilization was doing archaeological excavation, and although this is an anomaly and doesn't fit in with theirs, this is something that they found from an earlier find. And I've never come across anybody that could conceive of that, and it just amazed me. Down in Central America, they have something of a dump yard from an old museum that goes back to a former extinction, or to a society that extincted. And this dump is full of these terracotta statues of military apparatus, like a Cobra helicopter, like doctors and nurses wearing the garb, just one thing after another, all would fit in with our current society perfectly. And there are tens of thousands of these little figures there. I went down to see them.
They threw them away?
Well, when the extinction occurred, you know, somehow that museum was built in such a way that it survived, or these terracotta statues, figurines, wouldn't have survived. And so eventually, you know, somebody dumped them out on the ground, and they got buried. But, I mean, that is the explanation why they're there. And then people see these things and they can't figure it out, you know, oh my God, you know, because no one wants to really take the giant step and to see that when you find these things like a spark plug in a coal mine from 3,000 feet down, that these things have meaning, that they determine, that they're not just out there to be talked about and forgotten, that they point to a past of high technology that existed a long time ago.
Well, let me make another giant leap forward. I want to talk about the elongated skulls that seem to be associated with some of these monolithic structures and megalithic structures. Were the elongated skulls related to the civilization that came here from Mars, or what's your take on the elongated skulls?
No, they didn't come from Mars. They came from there. There are people that have that feature, and some were in early dynasty in Egypt, and that's responsible for the fashion of the headdress of the pharaohs. They were considered to be extremely wise.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were way ahead of the Egyptians or anybody on earth in understanding genetics. And they knew, since the Egyptians found that these people were so wise and so advanced and looked up to them, they followed a pattern that was set by this family. And that was, they understood that the offspring from a union between a son with his maternal aunt or a girl with her fraternal father is more apt to produce a copy of that particular person than the way that we go about it, a man and a woman, from a different heritage. And so they did that. To be Ra, son of the sun,
mm-hmm.
to be in the royal line, that's what you had to be. Therefore, the Jewish idea of Moses being Hebrew is just pure BS, because they kept very close records of who was in that line. Moses was a Pharaoh, and he was Akhenaten, and all the 33rd degree Masons know that, and so do the Illuminati, and you know, this is the kind of knowledge that marks their secret societies, and they make them feel superior and all that crap.
Do you think the people with these elongated skulls had more cranial capacity and maybe more powerful brain in some way?
No, they had unified consciousness. They had access to genetic knowledge and collective consciousness because of unified consciousness. And your ancestors had it too. And these people weren't any superior intellectually. They just had they came from a more advanced culture. And they tried to share some of that. They showed the monument building could be done better if they used a particular kind of concretion and used molds. And so that's how most of these pyramids subsequently were built.
Were the people with the elongated skulls more closely linked to Cydonia?
No, they came from somewhere else. They came from way out. The people that are connected with Cydonia, your ancestors. They looked just like you, only they had unified consciousness until they came to Earth.
Now, when you said these other people came from way out, do you mean beyond Earth?
A minimum of 100 light years away.
Oh. Well, Crystal, I'm going to let you take over here because... this sounds like new material to me.
Oh, well, you know, we did a show on this some time ago, not just the elongated skull people, but also the cone heads.
Ah.
Because there were cone heads here as well. There have been a lot of different kinds of peoples here trying to coexist with humans and not doing very well. Like we were discussing earlier, it reminded me of that quote, gods don't kill people, people with gods kill people. There was a lot of that going on, and a lot of them didn't survive it. There may still be peoples here that we have not discovered, and until we get our act together, for their sake, I hope it stays that way. The Earth also has a history from before we arrived here. I think that's very important to take into consideration also, because there are histories that we may have come across that are not our own histories, that may be spliced in with some of the other fairy tales we have and adapted so that humans believe that those are the stories of our ancestors, when in fact they aren't. And I think, most of all, though, people should keep in mind There's a reason that these things are hidden from us, and they are not good reasons. And even more importantly, the truth is so much more wondrous than the lie. It really is.
So, in a previous show, have you guys discussed in detail the people with the elongated skulls that came from 100 light years away?
Yes. They crashed and first established in the Grand Canyon. And In the Grand Canyon, there's a place where there are a series of carved out chambers at different levels, and a rancher found them. And a few years, I went there, but by the time that I got there, they were all fenced off and had guards. But from what I've read and what I've seen pictures of, I can pretty well assure you that these were elongated head people. Now, they probably found the New World too savage to try to establish in. So after their experience in the Grand Canyon, I think they went on to Egypt, and I think that they established themselves there because you had people that were ahead of hunters and gatherers who were had already established subsistence level agriculture that had learned how to irrigate the Nile, and had also begun to develop the Bronze Age, so that which didn't happen in the New World, even up to Columbus. So they found, they became accepted. They became very, very well liked and regarded, and established what led to the union of the Upper and Lower Nile, and created a Great Egypt that we have today. And the way of seeding the royal line persisted up until the Ptolemaic dynasty, and where you were a son of Ra, or you were a son of the sun. You bore Ra. And if you will look at the hieroglyphs that relate to Moses, you will see that he was called Moses Ra. So to be designated Ra meant you were a son of the sun, meant that you were the offspring of a union between your maternal aunt, or you were the son of a woman who had a unity with her paternal uncle. And that never changed until the Ptolemy dynasty.
So the people that came from 100 light years away with the elongated skulls, they settled also in the Grand Canyon. Now there are these giant caverns in the Grand Canyon that are like cut out of the side of the canyon, where they found artifacts and things.
Yes.
So you're talking about those people, right?
Yeah, and tell you quite honestly that down in the bottom where they kept their life support systems, they found battery acids that they've used since in their space probes and other things, because these things, if they use them, I mean, the best battery we can buy is a lithium battery. These things will last 100 times longer. If we use these salts in the batteries today, you buy a car, you got a battery that whenever that car wears out, you pull that battery out and put in the next one. That's the kind of battery you would have. If they made the plates in a battery anyway out of copper instead of lead, it would be just about as good. But of course, everything on this planet is made with a short lifetime, so that the monsters that control industry can make more money off the consumer. And then they'll bitch about, oh, well, too many people here, all their garbage, you know, building up these land, filling up these landfalls and all this stuff. Yeah, because of your greed. It's not because they're consumers. You know, this planet can support a great many more people than are already here if the system is not corrupted.
Yeah, the system's so broken now.
It is broken, and you see, we're becoming aware of the corruption, and that's why they want to get rid of most of the people, because there are too many for them to manage. That's why they want our guns in America. You know, America is held out because of the Second Amendment, and they want our guns so that they can play God on our asses. You know, that's what it's all about. And, you know, you take a monster like Feinstein, for instance, a Zionist. It does the bidding, is a toad for the elite. And, you know, to some extent, everybody in Congress, with the exception of maybe three or four people, is a toady in some way for the funds to run their next campaign. It's all they think about. And, you know, they know they're wrong. They know that they're not representing the interests of the American people. And they rationalize, well, there's so too many people, maybe depopulation is the only way. Yeah. You know, and they're convoluted thinking. And that's what we have. Besides the fact, if we got somebody who has charisma and who could lead, would stand up and people would listen to, would lead us out of this darkness. They'll clone the son of a bitch, kill him, and use the clone. Don't think they don't. Don't think they don't. I think that's what they did to Kerry.
John Kerry? Have you seen those photos?
Oh.
He's about as non-human as it gets. If you just pay attention, he's about as non-human. He has no, you know, it's like a succubus sucked his personality out and left this robot toad.
I feel that way about the president too.
Oh well, that's just a mongrel. Obama's a mongrel. You know, he smoked so much dope. He's, you know, been party to so many lies, a corrupt Chicago gangster politician. You know, I mean, he's got everything going for him. And, you know, in the first place, he's controlled because, you know, he's not American. He's not eligible to hold office in this country, even as a senator or a representative. And you know, that's the kind of thing they want. The power elite wants some string to hold on everybody that they back and tailor for a powerful position in government or in the military. And until they have that string tied, and they own this person, until they do that, they're not going to put them in a position of power. They just might get rid of them if it doesn't work out. But that's what all of this pedophilia is about. That's what all of this Satanism is about, because they can get you to do something through these vehicles that they can blackmail you for the rest of your life.
That's the way they maintain their control, right?
Yes, yes. They do it through, you know, it is worse than I'm saying. And there's some things I don't talk about because I don't want to add to the terror that these monsters want to inflict on people. And there are a lot of people that just haven't come far enough to realize that we are just a breath away from a point where you will feel like you have nothing left to lose. And then they want us, before that happens, before the masses reach that point, they want to begin exterminating them. Because they know what's going to happen next.
That's right.
That's what it's all about. And look, It's an inevitable truth.
You know, James actually talked about this during the last show we did with you too, Mark, and there's an article that I would like to direct people to. It was written by the 21stCenturyWire.com, and the title of the article is "The Israeli Blackmail Machine. The Clintons Weren't the Only Ones." And there's a brief snippet here. It says, "Perhaps the bigger issue is the stranglehold over the U.S. presidency by Israel and the tricks they have yet to unleash. How valuable would these type of sex tapes be when Israel is carpet bombing Gaza in the face of Washington? When nothing ever seems to add up, as is the case with the U.S.-Israel waltz, maybe that's because of blackmail material kept in a safe place. The reality that our elected officials are one Franklin scandal away from complete political castration is an unsettling reality. The secret sex cabal and recordings that reside in Benjamin Netanyahu's private collection may point to the very reasons many U.S. presidents are never forthcoming to the atrocities committed by the Netanyahu regime." And so this has become the new norm. So now we're looking at a society, a future society, because they've gotten away with it thus far, in which the requirement to be to hold a political office will be that you are blackmailable.
That's
so it's
exactly,
only going to go downhill from there.
And it's been true. It's been true now. It has been a trend. Of course, they thought JFK, since he came from a family of mobsters, and Joe Kennedy was a mobster. He made his money bootlegging. And he wasn't a mobster in the sense of Al Capone or Meyer Lansky, but he was a mobster. And so with him being very close to one of the most powerful men in the world, Aristotle Onassis, he actually earned a credit that one of his sons would be president. Such things happen. And so his eldest son, that was tailored for that position, you know, to be a monster, died, was killed in the war. So it fell to JFK, and JFK did not want it. JFK had a back injury from Vietnam. He just didn't have the disposition, the lust for power or anything like that. But his mother insisted. So he said, okay. And he tried to make a difference. He was a good man. One of the rarities. Maybe they had, felt like they had some kind of hold on him, but it didn't work out. And so he came, they did everything they could to vilify him before he was murdered. And, you know, the latest assessment by any of the analysts that have looked for what happened to him, how he was murdered, points right to the CIA and to the Secret Service. I mean, it's indelible. And, you know, after that, everybody of any power or authority that got involved did everything they could to suppress evidence, to persecute and prosecute witnesses, and kill them. All the way up and all the way down the scale of those that were involved in the whitewash, including Earl Warren, who was one of the worst, and he was the author of the Warren Commission report. So, you know, he told Jack Ruby, when Jack Ruby, after Jack Ruby was in jail for assassinating Oswald, he told, Jack Ruby said, "If you'll take me to Washington, D.C., I'll tell you everything I know. But if I say anything here, they'll kill me." And Earl Warren told him, "Well, if you're afraid you'd be in any danger by saying anything, don't say it." That is a good example, a metaphor for the way everything was conducted in the so-called truth finding that followed the assassination of one of our greatest presidents.
Myra, you don't have any corrupt politicians in Scotland, do you?
Yeah. You almost made me cover myself with coffee. Thank you.
No, it's everywhere, really. It's global.
There is one more thing I would like to go back to from the last show we did. There's something I would like to follow up on. One of the things that's so important, so important, is for people to look at patterns and understand patterns, patterns of behavior, patterns of history. I think that, I mean, anyone can do it. They're not taught to do it because then they would understand what's really happening. And I think this also feeds into the transhumanist agenda, doesn't it? Because the only way you're ever going to be whole and complete or capable is if you're somehow augmented. But it's not necessary. When you
well,
know...
Well, Crystal, I look at it a little bit differently, but I agree with you absolutely. I'd say this. They're destroying the earth, and they're kind of trying to plant a compensation in people's mind that, oh, well, I know that as you are, you can't survive. We'll make you different so you can survive whatever we do to the earth.
That's definitely a part of it, too. But when you understand the patterns that these people use and operate with, you can predict their next move. Because you know they're at A and they want to get to D, so you know that B and C have to come next. So there was something that I said during the last 5 minutes of the last show. I'm going to read it to you, and then I'm going to compare it with some recent articles that have come out. And this was about the border. When the border crisis happened, I was very concerned, and I was telling people, you know, it's important that we watch all of the pieces on the board, but this one is really important. There's something going on here. So at the end of the show, we started talking about the border, and this is what I said. What I'm concerned about the border is we recently had Zionist Feinstein come out and say, ooh, there's another terrorist attack going to happen, and she knows because she's seen the plans, and I'm sure she is because she probably helped write the plan. And then we had Dick Cheney and some other social engineers come out and say, oh, it's coming. And poof, we have a border crisis. And the next thing you know, ooh, members of Al-Qaeda are sneaking through the border. I think they said they caught 7 of them. So this is opening the gateway. Psychologically, they are seeding the population to accept terrorism on our own soil. Now, yesterday, this article came out. Islamic terrorist groups are operating in the Mexican border city of Ciudad Juarez and planning to attack the United States with car bombs and other vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices. High-level federal law enforcement, intelligence, and other sources have confirmed to Judicial Watch that a warning bulletin for an imminent terrorist attack on the border has been issued. So you see where this is going. We know that they have to push harder and harder and harder, not just to take our guns, but it's the terror. They have to terrorize people into falling in line with the New World Order. That's so important, and it's been working. So this particular article was called Imminent Terrorist Attack Warning by Feds on U.S. Border, but it will escalate. You will start having bombings at malls, car bombings, and this will become the new Gaza ghetto. This can't happen. When you know where they want to go, you can predict how they plan to get there based on the way they've gotten there before. It's always the same pattern, always. There's a fellow here, his name is David Laurie Vanderbeek, who's running for governor, and he's pretty awake. He put out an article a week or two ago that Las Vegas is a target for the terrorists. Do you see where this is going? So how many more rights and privileges do you think you're going to have taken away when the mythical Al-Qaeda that crossed through the open border is car bombing the malls and high schools and casinos? This is, you see what I'm saying? James talks a lot about incrementalism, and it's true. They do. They have to set it up. It's like the long con. You know, there's different phases. And when the border crisis happened, the moment they said they caught Al-Qaeda coming through, everybody should have known exactly what that was about.
Yeah, CIA. Who created the Al-Qaeda? And who created ISIS? The CIA. All of these
That's
are
right.
fabrications by the CIA to conduct these socially engineered scenarios, inflicting more and more terror. But I tell you, there's something counterproductive about all of this. And I noticed this whenever there was a gun store very close to me called Cheaper Than Dirt. And I would go down there, and every time that there would be one of these false flags or whatever, I'd go down there, and that place would be full. People would be buying all this ammunition and guns and all that stuff. Every time that Spoofball, Feinstein, or any of that group, any time that they start their crap about gun control, any time that they do, here come a load of people, and I've run to them. You know, I was telling you that I go out to the Naval Air Force Base here in Fort Worth. It used to be Carswell. And I go out; they sell guns out there.
Really?
In the commissary, there's a little store that's attached to the commissary, and they sell guns in there. It's where they have the garden supplies and so, you know, all the hardware. And they sell guns in there. And so I go in there, and there are people buying guns, you know, and not just any guns, assault rifles, guns that have a lot of power. They're handguns that they really don't want you to have, but they're for sale. And so one of the funny things that recently came up is Obama is trying to outlaw body armor.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, body armor.
That's so ridiculous.
Yeah, he wants you killed. So, now body armor is not something that you're going to go out and hurt anybody with. You're just going to protect your life.
Right.
And now body armor is to be outlawed. It just doesn't stop. If the American people, first of all, if we had an honest Supreme Court that was doing its job, and that is, which is constitutional review. They're supposed to keep everybody honest with the Constitution. That's their job. That's what the Supreme Court was envisioned to be. And under some of the best Supreme Court justices we've had, that's been made clear over and over again. John Marshall made that clear over and over again. He was a very conservative Supreme Court justice, chief Supreme Court justice, and he wrote more opinions than have ever been written by anyone, and they were flawless. I mean, I wouldn't agree with his politics, and most other people wouldn't, because he's ultra-conservative. But that's exactly what you need on the Supreme Court. Instead, we have monsters like Sotomayor and people that, you know, wouldn't have been confirmed, wouldn't even have had a chance of being mentioned 50 years ago, because they're far from scholars. They're far from having an impeccable history. No, Sotomayor, who is a racist and has made a comment that white men should be castrated. And this is what they confirm on the Supreme Court. You know, it tells you how if somebody will follow my agenda, I don't care if they're Jack the Ripper. Doesn't it?
You know, the other thing, I don't want to go too much longer today, guys. I don't want to burn us out. One of the things I'd like to hear you guys comment on, maybe all three of you, since Myrit hasn't even had a chance to talk yet, but I'd like to all of you to tell me why the elite bad guys are not archons, they're not fallen angels, they're not reptilians, and they're not ETs. Because there's a lot of strangeness in the UFO community, and there are a lot of quote-unquote researchers that kind of take us down that path. Who wants to start? Anybody?
Myrid, why don't you start? I didn't even know that you joined us until you started talking, so I'm glad that you were able to make it. Why don't you?
Snuck in late. Well, I can speak from personal experience that they have a lot of interest in keeping people off the page and distracted and going down many different rabbit holes and not getting anywhere. And I think a lot of money and time is spent on getting people to do that. It's kind of like during the Second World War, one of the things that helped win the war was people spewing out disinformation all the time. And my mother was one of those people because she worked for Cypher, and all she did was put out code that meant nothing. And if you think of it nowadays, I actually think we are at a kind of silent war for information and knowledge in order to save ourselves on this planet. And there's, you know, what we're up against it, and we're up against people who have a vested interest in spewing out a lot of disinformation, misleading people, lying over and over again, and taking control of your mind, you know, and doing, and people want others to do the thinking for them. They want other people to do the activism for them and do nothing. And that needs to stop, because, you know, knowledge is power. You become informed, you become empowered, and hopefully become motivated. And they don't want that. They don't want that to be the case. So it's in their best interest to keep everyone running around in the wrong direction and not pointing the finger at the people who are doing this. And they're very human. They're not archons. They're not reptiles. They're not from another planet, you know. They're psychopathic, and it's hard for us, as I've said this before, it's very hard for us to understand them, because in order to do that, you have to be a psychopath yourself. And that's why I cannot get my head around it a lot of the time, and the only way I can understand it is to look at it historically, and look how far back it goes and how much worse it's got.
Very well said, Myron. Very well said. Crystal, tell us why the elites are not archons, fallen angels. They're not reptilians. They're not interdimensional ETs. Please elaborate.
Well, primarily because they have names and addresses on this planet. We know they're humans. I think that there are a lot of cowards on this planet, and I think that they are catered to repeatedly, because when you tell someone or encourage someone to believe that your enemy is from they're from another planet and they have superpowers and they can mind meld and zap you with their laser beams, what chance do you have, right? And this is also the disguise. It's the cover story, because it hides, these stories hide the true nature of the perpetrators. It hides the real dirty faces and bloody hands. And it reminds me of those cartoons from when I was a kid, when bank robbers would run out of a bank and then they would, you know, change their outfit really quick, and then the police would run up and say, which way did they go? And they point, and the cops take off after, you know, a non-existent bank robber, while the other ones laugh all the way, you know, to their hideout with the money. And that's really what's going on. That's really what's going on. It's smoke and mirrors. That's all.
You know, James, what bothers me is that so many researchers in the UFO world now are going down this rabbit hole of that the elite are really archons, they're fallen angels, they're interdimensional ETs, they're reptilians. This is just, I really think it's taken us away from common sense, and it's completely steering us down a wrong path. I wondered if you could have the final word on all this.
Well, it draws interest. They want to sell books, they want to get paid to lecture, et cetera, et cetera. It's the ufology cottage industry crap all over again. But what I'd like to say is, as far as what we're talking about, I would like to talk about Scott Peck's book, The Road Less Traveled. In that book, he gives an example. He was a psychiatrist, and he believed in most of the approaches to psychiatry that were conventional or standard medical practice, until he had one case. And in this case, these parents had come to him concerned over their younger son. Their older son had committed suicide, and they told him they were afraid that this younger one would follow suit. So he said, well, I'll talk to him and maybe take him on as a patient. So he did, and he spent some time with the boy, and he found the boy healthy, well-balanced and everything. And then one day, the boy comes in and he's dejected. And the psychiatrist said, well, what's going on? And he said, well, it's my birthday today. And he said, well, that... Why would you be dejected over that? He said, my parents gave me a .22 rifle. And he says, well, do you like to shoot or whatever? And he says, yeah. He says, well, what makes you upset about that? And he said, well, it's the gun my brother used to commit suicide.
Oh.
Then, at that moment, Scott Peck says, I discovered evil. I knew there was such a thing as evil. Because, see, these people, for the convenience of making money and not finding honest solutions, not addressing real problems, but nursing illness, had built up this approach that there's no evil. It's all relative and all this BS. Well, there is evil. There are people that are pathological narcissists, and almost everyone is unfortunate enough to have one in their family somewhere. And if you can imagine, take this person that you can think of. If you may be lucky and you don't have any pathological narcissists in your family. I did. Just imagine giving these people power of life and death over others, and what would happen. And that's what we have here on Earth. We have looked the other way about these people among us. We have given them every opportunity out of pity or whatever. We've created a society where they have become very handy to the elite who use them. And that's what's wrong with the world today.
Good common sense. You know, we need to get back to good common sense. I want to thank you guys for doing both shows today. And I'll go ahead and save this. And